Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers and electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free and available when they're interested in listening to it. Today we have an interesting show, which may signal a change in direction for ESI Bytes, where we just talked to Judge Fatchiol, the retiring federal magistrate judge in the District of Columbia, about his thoughts on e-discovery as he approaches retirement. Back in 2009, we did the first ESI Bytes program, and my initial guest was Judge Fatchiol. We talked about an issue on that show that he'd spoken about at the Georgetown Advanced e-Discovery Conference that year, which grabbed my attention. He had talked about the challenges of small law firms and entities without e-discovery expertise and their access to e-discovery talent and knowledge, which in a sense made access to, you know, fairness and the opportunity to use the judicial system. Now with Judge Fatchiol stepping down from the bench, I thought it'd be a nice opportunity to look back at this issue and some of the other issues which Judge Fatchiol is most passionate about in e-discovery. And I also thought it'd be a nice opportunity to talk about a possible future direction for ESI Bytes, as it's no secret that finding time to hit on substantive issues like we've done in 205 prior podcasts on a free program is harder and harder to find the time to do. But we've had close to 500,000 downloads of the show spread over 205 podcasts. It's been successful, but frankly, I can't find the time to do the shows like I'd like to, so I have an idea I'm going to throw out at the end, which ties into the subject matter of the program. So let me briefly introduce Judge Fatchiol. Judge has written some great e-discovery opinions, which I'm not going to go through here, but spoken all over the country and world, literally, on e-discovery issues, has helped both large and small organizations with educational efforts. Frankly, he's been a mentor for me here at ESI Bytes. I'm not sure I would have started this program, but for hearing that presentation at Georgetown, which got me thinking this would be a great avenue to get that information out to the, you know, general public that can't afford to go to Georgetown or other, you know, costly CLE programs. Judge Fatchiol has been very active within the Sedona Conference, Georgetown, Legal Tech, virtually every major legal conference. The list goes on and on. So Judge, I'm thrilled to have you here on the show again as a bookend of sorts for the old format of ESI Bytes and perhaps the kickoff to a new format.
Good to be with you, Carl, and happy Thanks. Holidays.
Yeah, and happy holidays to you and to all the listeners. So Judge Fatchiol, do we still have challenges bridging this gap between the large law firms and e-discovery and everyone else, this topic you talked about in 2009?
Yes, we still do. The question, of course, is whether it is diminishing, and perhaps it is. Obviously, we're now seeing most large law firms having a subdivision within the firm that has a particular expertise in this area. There may be also another subdivision in the firm which deals with questions of privacy and security, which are intimately connected. So the large law firms have obviously restructured their organizations to meet this challenge. Smaller law firms obviously don't have that luxury of subdividing a section of the firm. So there becomes the question is how do you disseminate the information that must be known among the people within a smaller law firm who must know it? That is the challenge we face. In other words, how do we make this a more universal part of every toolkit, every trial lawyer or otherwise has? We're beginning to see, I think, some important developments. Certainly, I am now seeing in our Title VII cases an increasing sophistication by both plaintiff and defense counsels as to these issues, since 98% of all communications are electronic. Just in the past month or so, I mediated a controversy in a Title VII case between a small firm and the government on how to search a particular database. So it's slowly and quietly percolating down. It just takes a willingness to learn. There certainly are more opportunities than can be imagined to learn that dwarf opportunities that were available 10 or 12 years ago. So I think it's just getting the lawyers in a position to know what they don't know and finding the ways to learn it.
So I guess, as you've always said, common law works over time, and
yeah.
And we have special master programs and things like that
yeah.
to help push people along. So
I think we're going to see a unique challenge arriving pretty soon. The
malpractice bar in medical cases had a discrete sort of practice because all the records that pertain to this human being were in one folder. That, of course, is now dissipating with the arrival of electronic health records. So we are uniquely challenged by that as in that particular area of the law. It's going to take a great amount of imagination to understand how those records work, how they differ, how one collects that information. It's an extraordinary challenge. I participated in a conference on this at Johns Hopkins talking about it, and I learned an enormous amount about electronic health records and how they are coming into existence. Indeed, I have my own chart, electronic chart, that I can consult, and I'm amazed that the test results are on it by the time I get home from the doctors. So that's a new world for lawyers, and they're going to be challenged by it in a lot of different ways.
Yep, no doubt. So, you know, one of my thoughts on this program is talking to guests across the country who've been successful in e-discovery and trying to find out, you know, how did you get to where you ended up? There have to have been some situations which pushed you in this direction, since judges encounter so many interesting issues on substantive and procedural areas of law, and it, you know, to establish a real foothold here. What got you in this direction?
Well, it was this first case. It was McPeak versus Ashcraft, which was a Title VII case. And an issue arose as to whether certain backup tapes. Well, I think I'd been a judge for just a few months. And I got thinking about it, and I said, well, you know, it's not like a file cabinet. It's a certain new thing, and it maybe needs some new ways of thinking about it. And I came up with some notions of how to approach it. And thought a lot about how we spend money. In other words, how are we going to spend money so that we could use it effectively? Are we spending too much money? And I used the old concept of marginal utility. Will doing this really improve our flow of information so that we can get the information that is important in this lawsuit? But can we do it without bankrupting ourselves? That's really all I did, and the next thing I know, the phone was ringing, and people were asking me to go here and go there to talk about this, and I continued to do so, and blessed by all of those experiences, I certainly learned a lot more than I thought. I became involved in a community of people, primarily at Sedona and at Georgetown, who were as interested in as I in these issues, and it grew. Then around here, the judges of the court, the district court judges, being aware of my familiarity with this issue, would refer to me cases in which those issues arose. So it was in a very nice way. There was a perfect synergy, but what I was doing as a judge and what I was doing as a teacher and a lecturer, and I was really blessed by the opportunity.
Yeah, I found personally that cost-benefit analysis lends itself to being an entrepreneur in e-discovery, because when you see the money that's being spent,
yeah,
just tweaking what you're doing can make you look like a hero in many instances, but it's breaking that paradigm of, well, that's the way the lawyer before me did it, you know?
that is true.
So where do you see the biggest challenges or opportunities
in
e-discovery?
The one you just mentioned. We still haven't gotten our hands completely around marginal utility. How do we approach this issue so that we are spending money effectively? You know my concerns that if this gets out of hand, and I think in many instances it is badly out of hand in terms of cost, it will drive all but the rich from the federal courts. And that's a terrible thing. We cannot tolerate that. As I've said to everyone who will hear me, I didn't become a judge so I could be the monitor in a playground where only the rich could play. So the question now becomes, how do we bring this technology into common knowledge and common use in the courts, but how do we do it in a way so that the courts remain equally available to all people, irrespective of how much money they have? That is the challenge. I don't think there is any other challenge that it's even close to that one in its importance. And that's why the new rules are going to be fascinating to watch as they grapple with this issue of proportionality in this area.
Yeah, I thought your Georgetown presentation this year was pretty remarkable, and you mentioned that you were trying to remember the last time you saw a middle-income person in your courtroom. That's just scary.
Yeah, and they do come when Congress has created a statute that permits fee shifting. But then you have to look at the other side of the coin, which is, who are the defendants in this case? and can they afford the burden of the litigation by virtue of the fact that they will pay not only their own fees but the other person's fees if they are unsuccessful. So it's a knife that cuts both ways. I had a recent opinion in which I tried to think about that issue and realize that it cuts across the table in the courtroom. Both the plaintiff and defendant are driven very hard by what is this going to cost and what is its ultimate benefit to me, whether I'm successful or not successful.
Well, I know something you've been very passionate about is education. You know, what types of education programs are you involved in, and are you seeing any results from those efforts?
Yes, I am. I'm seeing results almost on a daily basis from the efforts I've made over the years. I've reached the wonderful point where the people I've taught, are now teaching. That is, I will go to a program and see two of my former students on the next panel. So the dream that people like Richard Brayman and Larry Center and others have had, that we would create a cadre of people who could teach other people, seems to be coming through. You know, there's always this problem. If you finish one of those programs and you've reached 50 people or 100 people, you wonder, how can we multiply this so we're reaching thousands of people? Well, we're not there yet, but we seem to be moving in the right direction. We are getting together a cadre of people who understand this stuff and blessedly are willing to share their time and expertise with everyone else. In terms of the programs I'm affiliated with, the most unusual one is the Electronic Discovery Training Academy. And that's quite different from the traditional CLE program. Our students, and we limit the program to about 50, arrive on a Sunday where they're matched up with coaches, you know, wonderful lawyers here in the District of Columbia who have expertise. And then we begin a five-day program, which goes from 8:30 in the morning to 5:30 at night. The first 2 days are highly technical under the supervision of a marvelous man, Craig Ball, who works them very hard and understanding the technology. Then the next couple of days, we weave in more traditional legal areas. In the evenings, they are working with their coaches and preparing for a mock meet and confer, which will take place before a judge on Friday morning. And we gather judges, diverse groups of judges, Court of Claims, a local court here, to give the students an experience of how judges from different places react to what they're doing. So when we complete the program, the evaluations are always the same. They are, God, you worked me to death, but I don't know of any other period in my life where I learned so much in such a constricted part of a time. Now, that's an ideal. I don't know how many people can give up a week of their lives to do that, but those who do benefit greatly. Whether that program will grow and become a model, I don't really know, because it involves such an extraordinary commitment of time. And I don't know if law firms can afford that. But I think in the long run, if they do, they will find that they will bring back into the firm after the program people who really know what they're doing and who are going to be that much more marketable to clients.
Yeah, I also think part of it's just being aware that if the first time you're in that situation, you're not going to do it perfectly, but taking an honest look on how you did, where you made your mistakes. Thank God for mistakes, because once you realize you made them, you become smarter, and you move forward, you know.
Yeah.
But that's a sort of common law thing.
And then on the first Sunday of the new year, I'll be attending the American Association of Law Schools program. We're going to do a program on technology and competence and the law school curriculum. So I'm very anxious to see what happens there. That is a concern. I taught a course at Georgetown this fall for the first time called Information Technology and Modern Litigation, and learned a lot from that experience of how to integrate this into the traditional law school curriculum.
So when you look back at your career, and this may be an easier question for me or someone else to answer for you, and I'll try to help, but what helped you the most to become a leader in the field? I mean, you talked about McPeak, which is sort of being in the right place at the right time, but then you ran with it, and you've become one of these judges who the e-discovery community looks to for guidance on how the rules would be interpreted. The myriad of issues that people grapple with, at the programs that you speak at.
Well, first of all, as I say, this community came into existence. I can't think of any other point in the history of American legal history where this occurred. That is, where a group of people came together of common interest and began to feed off each other in a remarkable way. And Sedona was a very good example, and Georgetown was a very good example, and in many respects, they were the same people. So you had this enriching community that was anxious to learn and to exchange ideas and a willing audience to listen. I don't know if I would have done any of the things I had done but for the opportunities presented me by Sedona and these CLE programs at Georgetown and otherwise. As I say, you know, there's a line, if you're a teacher, by your students, you are taught. And that was really the point. It was the interaction with the audience from which I think helped me understand these issues and understand the way people were grappling with them.
And yeah, I agree. I think it's that community, because I've seen it in groups I've been involved with in local efforts. And Tom Allman had this vision of local groups of people which turned into Friends of eDiscovery. And I helped start about six of them with Pete Pepitone and Tom Allman. And, you know, we've got seven or eight of them around the country. And you meet continuously. And those are the people that hopefully reach the people that aren't showing up but get stuck in one of these cases.
Yeah.
But, you know, the other thing that I've seen, your sense of humor and your ability to, you know, convey with very graphical, interesting stories, how crazy some of the things we encounter are. Most people I know in this field have a good sense of humor, and I think there's a reason for it.
Well, yeah, I think, that, you know, one of the, when you get to be an old man like me and you look at the way the world has changed, all you can do is laugh. I mean, I'm still thinking of just in the semester with my students, and I was trying to explain to them what a typewriter was, and I could have been describing life on Mars. I mean, and when you've seen the kind of technological change that I have seen in my life and the way it's transformed reality, all you can do is giggle and say, my God, what's coming next? It's particularly true when you have grandchildren like mine, and they have remarkable technical competence at a ridiculously young age. So the sense of humor comes just from the fact that I'm just stupefied by all the changes there have been.
So what advice do you have for lawyers who want to learn more about eDiscovery, especially the lawyers who might be in law firms that don't take the eDiscovery challenges as matters which are worth lawyers spending their time on when compared to substantive issues of law? And they still exist. They really still do. It's scary sometimes.
Well, I always tell young people that if they go to a law firm and the law firm does not want to invest in their professional development, they should leave as soon as possible, because that law firm is on its way to destruction. I mean that because the most precious thing that law firm has is those young people, and those young people have to be permitted to grow and to learn, and the older lawyers must help them. And if they are not, I see no future for that law firm, because as I just said a minute ago, things are changing so rapidly it's almost beyond comprehension. So I don't really understand how any law firm worthy of the name is not engaged in making sure that its young people are getting the professional development they need. That's particularly important these days because we try so few cases. There is really no quick way to pick up the fundamental litigation skills that a lawyer should have in the traditional law firm practice, except by volunteering to do pro bono work. We don't have the luxury of the old days where, you know, you could cut your teeth on a slip and fall case at the Safeway. Now everything is a monumental piece of litigation that goes on forever, and it's almost exclusively a paper practice and a discovery practice. So these young lawyers are hungering to learn more skills than they are learning in traditional law firms, and they have to be permitted to do so. And one of those skills is how to handle electronic information in the context of litigation. So to answer your question, the young people have to have their development. Now, I think once the young people get that development, it passes on to the older people with whom they are associated in brief writing and in trying cases and doing everything else has to do. As to those older lawyers, I don't know what to tell them except to say that this is fun. It's a new way of doing things. It is intimidating initially, but once you get over that intimidation, the amount of time and money that can be saved is enormous. You really can have the kind of relationship with your clients where your clients, who are technologically competent, can have the confidence that you're not wasting their money. If you don't get these skills, that's exactly what you're going to do.
Yeah, and I, you know, from my experiences, when I was special master on a billion-dollar asbestos case a year or so ago, You know, I tried out some newer technology in that case, realizing essentially I had what I characterized as a terminal cancer patient because there was no cure the traditional way. I had 40 days to get through 1.3 million records and organize them, produce them for a trial deadline, which was appearing in the Wall Street Journal. And we opted for newer technology and trying a network of lawyers in disparate cities. And we saved $1 million in the review. The returns are so great and the challenges are so daunting, usually solutions with technology can move mountains for you. And you know, it's recognizing that the risk usually, as long as you draft what you're doing and get some consensus and explain it and are willing to sign off on it, you know, it's hard to get spanked for trying something in a daunting situation when you're trying to save money.
Of course.
I think, isn't that what the new rules are somewhat about? Trying to get that thought process down.
That's right. I mean,
so,
you know, the future belongs to the creative. I mean, anybody can figure out a drudgery and the slowest way to do something that doesn't require a lot of brain power. But that's not what we need.
It's the form book mentality, unfortunately, of who did it before me that is sometimes maddening.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, well, to change the topic a little bit, I know how much Richard Brayman meant to you and frankly to most of the eDiscovery community. And like everyone who knew Richard, and he was a guest here on ESI Bytes twice in the past and was the founder of Sedona Conference, we were all very saddened this year when he passed away. His big push for the last few years was this cooperation movement. And do you think it's getting better or worse?
It's getting much better. I mean, I had the honor of eulogizing Richard before we laid him to rest in the red clay hills of Sedona he loves so much. And I know how crucial he thought this notion of cooperation and transparency were if the law was going to move forward in, as he would put it, a just and reasoned way. I'm seeing it all around. One of these days I'm going to write a law review article and I'm just going to focus on how many times the words meet and confer appear in judicial opinions. It's hard to find one that doesn't have it. The judges are seeing this process as being an iterative process where the parties have to keep working with each other, not just once, but throughout the process to keep it within manageable levels. And I'm seeing that cooperation just about everywhere. I mentioned the case I had just a couple weeks ago. I've had another matter before me involving, we started with thousands of documents that as to which privilege was claimed, began to work through them. And ultimately, my in-camera requirement, which I just finished, was manageable. Without the cooperation of lawyers, that would have been impossible. We just don't have the luxury of an adversary system in which there's a fight about everything. We can't afford that anymore. We've got to pick our fights. We've got to pick our shots. That's crucial. That was Richard's point. And remember, Richard was an antitrust lawyer, so he knew what a big case was. He knew what a lot of documents were. He knew what that cost. So he just didn't think of cooperation as an aspirational ideal, but as a practical way of getting from point A, i.e. the commencement of this lawsuit, to point B, its fair resolution. That's what it's all about.
You know, you mentioned another name in there, and Jonathan Redgrave, and I recently had a chance to follow the Facciola Redgrave proposed bucketing approach as an alternative to putting privilege logs together, and it was really through, you know, looking at a situation which appeared to be was going to be painful, you know, when you're throwing together descriptions with lots of people, you get something that appears to be quilted together by a blind person, you know, with descriptions that either may be overly broad or too narrow, but in most instances will be inconsistent. And, you know, that's impossible to solve by trying to do this in a time deadline with looking at every document with people that aren't talking to each other. And even if they are, it's impossible to solve. So today, you know, I love that article. We used it, and I think I'm hoping it turns into a strategy that works, but I think it will. But what are your thoughts on privilege logs today? You know, and
The article, one acceptance of it, I believe one of the divisions of the New York Supreme Court have come up with a situation where they've said that either you're going to use a categorical approach to the to your assertion and challenge to a claim of privilege, or you're going to pay for the alternative, which I think is fascinating. But in terms of privilege logs, I don't know where we are going. I still persist in my view that we will never get lawyers and judges in the same room at the same time to agree as to how specific they should be. I know when I do an in-camera submission and I have to review it, and then I do my findings and my conclusions, I have to explain as carefully as I can without disclosing the contents what I am not permitting one side or the other to see. It is a great challenge, but it's a challenge well worth it, because remember, my opinion is going to be reviewed perhaps by a district court judge or by a circuit court judge, a panel, and they certainly are not going to reread these documents. So it's not fair of lawyers to say of judges, well, you don't know how demanding it is to try to be specific. Oh, yes, we do. We have to do it ourselves. But you're quite right. The lack of specificity of privilege logs doomed them. I mean, if it's just not specific, then I've got to look at the document. Well, then all of a sudden, my looking at the document converts a discovery dispute that can take a week or two to resolve to one that's going to take a month to resolve. We're talking about hundreds of documents. And remember another thing. Not all documents are completely and utterly privileged. The first paragraph may be, but the second paragraph may not be. And my Court of Appeals is quite clear that you have to do that segregation. So it's still an extremely demanding process. At this point in my career, as I'm about to leave the bench, I certainly would say, on my basis of my 17 and a half years, the whole logging process is a failure. That is, it is not being consistent with our obligation to find the most efficient way to do something. I don't know what the answer is, but I plan to devote myself to trying to find one, because I'm firmly convinced we can't go on like this. We can't spend millions of dollars logging documents. I'd feel less strongly about that if the documents were more significant than they are. But I'm always so frustrated when I finish one of these in-camera submissions to realize that 90% of the documents I looked at are never going to be seen again. They're not going to be used in discovery. They're not going to be used certainly at trial. That's the problem we have. We're looking at a mountain of information, and it's producing, at best, a mouse, if we're lucky.
Yeah, no, it's I always judge myself on marginal utility. Did what I do, is it something I'm happy with, let alone submitting a bill for it, And when you look at that task and you realize so much of it is privilege, but how do you describe it? to get the other side to agree, to my mind, it's like the Maginot Line situation that the French were in when they didn't want to, face World War II, and they wanted to build a defense, so they threw every conceivable, piece of armament down in the ground, like along a line on the border of the French-Belgian border, and what did the Germans do? They went around it, and to me, it's easier to defend privilege when you know what people are interested in, and then you've narrowed it down. I mean, it's the whole proportionality approach of the new federal rules. Let's talk about you have to give enough to give people the sense of what they want to ask about, mm-hmm. and then you can create better descriptions instead of trying to do it for the entire.
That's a very good point.
It's just common sense.
Yep.
But anyway. So this ties back into entrepreneurial thinking and law firms and in-house legal departments and how they deal with ESI creatively and effectively. This role of being an entrepreneur. I think we answered this already. Doesn't this first start with people willing to be entrepreneurs and lawyers at the same time?
That's a very good point. Sure, I would hope. I assume that clients want them to do have an entrepreneurial flair to it, so they are competing with other people and saying, hey, the way we do it is cheaper and better than the way the other guy is doing it. Sure, we want that.
Yeah, when I'm in these situations, I'm always very clear to say, well, I've never done it this way before, but this just seems to make a lot of sense to me to do it this way. And it seems to have worked you know, in predictive coding or, you know, with the, you know, I'm still waiting for the first failure, but it hasn't happened yet. Knock on wood, hopefully it won't, but if it does, I'll, you know, you learn from those situations.
Yeah.
So, now I'm not as passionate. We talked about predictive coding here. Just, you know, I mentioned it, and, you know, having been involved in global aerospace in 2012, which was the first case that got contested, I personally, much in the field, we thought TAR was just going to take off. And I've gotten a little fatigued by it. I guess the combination of working hard on the review business that I focus on, that I operate, and giving a year of my life to do this national tour in 2013 in 9 cities took a lot of the energy and starch out of me. Mm-hmm. But do you think we're making some progress with technology, things like TAR, or have we pushed the topic up into records management space without fixing our own house first?
No, I think we are making progress. I mean, the point is that it's now become just a reality. We can't possibly deal with these data sets in any other way. We're in the infancy of this, I think, and it's going to develop and change as the years go by, as the technology becomes more sophisticated. As we just mentioned, I don't see much of its use yet in privilege issues. I think that's a complicated question, particularly because, as I said, documents are never entirely one thing. A portion may be privileged, a portion may be not, and there may be waiver issues and so forth. But I think on the whole, and I'm a little more optimistic than you are, that we will be driven to other ways of doing, of technologically assisted ways of doing review, because we don't have any choice in the matter. And again, having practiced law for 45 years and remembering the unspeakable drudgery of doing page by page review of paper, we've got to go this way. I don't know what other solution there is. That way of doing things is extremely wasteful. Now, we will see as the technology goes. We will see if the present perception that human beings are not very good at doing this and machines are better, that, it seems to me, may be challenged. We may see some ways of where technologically assisted review has dangers of its own. But in terms of understanding the technology, I don't see how any lawyer can avoid that. Now that we're dealing with these data sets that are almost beyond our imagination in terms of their size.
So yeah, and you've touched both sides of the arguments with the law review article I wrote with Tom Grix, and then the article that Maura Grossman and Gordon wrote on their views. And you know, it is interesting because I had the nice opportunity to debate my friend Moore a couple times last year, and I look at the audience in this area, and I feel we have so much more work to do, because what I'm seeing is people are gravitating back to, essentially, instead of seeding with keywords, they're seeding with documents,
mm-hmm.
which means you find more of what you know.
Yeah.
And I think Maura works hard to find what she doesn't know, but I think the simple dumbing it down approach makes it harder to find what you don't know sometimes. So I think we have lots of issues still to grapple with.
Yeah. Well, that's necessary. I mean, you know, there must have been I always say that there had to be a time when the first railroad hit the first cow and someone started thinking about the impact of technology on law. So we've been there before. Someone gave me a wonderful book called The Victorian Internet. I think the Internet has had an extraordinary impact on human activity. Think about the telegraph. Think about what it was like to be a banker in New York and to need a draft on a Bank of England, and you usually had to write a draft and put it on a packet ship, and only God knows if it ever got to England. Then you walked across the hallway one day and somebody tapped a key and did it. That, to me, is at least as significant a development in human existence as what we've seen. Yet we grappled with it, didn't we? And the law grew up and handled these situations. So I think that's the aspiration. But I have very confidence that we will get through this and we'll learn a lot.
See, I should pick up the phone and call you whenever I get down about the field sometimes. You know, I feel better with that analogy.
Yeah, but the thing you and people your age and our listeners should realize is people my age, I'm 70, I'll be 70 on my next birthday. You know, there is what I call an unfortunate nostalgia for a time that never was. I made the joke about the typewriter, but you know how miserable it was to produce a brief on a typewriter? If you made a mistake on page 4, you got to go back and retype the whole damn thing. So lawyers who look back at were halcyon days of great innocence. It's just silly. The drudgery of the practice of law was pretty miserable. The drudgery of other things in human existence was remarkable as well. So technological change, I don't know if it's making us any better people, but it's certainly making us more efficient people.
No, that's true. Don't get me started on learning how to type on a manual typewriter. I'm destroying my knuckles typing on keyboards today. But anyway, so, you know, we talked briefly last week when I was in D.C. about having you share this show with me and evolving in a different direction and chatting with different guests about how they became established through mentors, entrepreneurship, or otherwise to become known in the field, to maybe shed some light on this entrepreneurship angle. Mm-hmm. Would you like to join me as a co-host of
Inside
Bites?
Sure, that'd be fun. But I probably would emphasize mentoring. I'm becoming firmly convinced that that's crucial. At a recent Bar Association dinner, I was honored with this list general, but the first two people who honored were young lawyers. And boy, somebody raised them right, because they got up and within a minute they were thanking all the people who had served as mentors already in their young lives. And it brought home to me how all of us could look back at someone who mentored us. And I wonder how we now formalize that in a different way so that every young person in this field, or any other field for that matter, can look to someone as a mentor, as someone who will simply listen to their concerns and give them guidance and ideas. So I'd be very interested about that.
And it's not just, who mentored them. It's, are they mentoring other people?
Exactly.
You know? What results of those? Yeah.
Are they passing it on? And how do we do that? Because, if you teach, you realize that, how crucial it is, how confusing the world can be without someone saying, well, you want to think about this and you want to think about that.
Okay, well, I got two people in mind for the next two shows, so we'll talk about that when this ends. And any future plans in starting in January other than the ESI Bites?
My successor is on his way here. He'll be here in a few minutes. And my first, talking about mentoring, is to help him in every way I can. I'm very busy already in terms of speaking engagements and teaching. It's funny, I have a calendar on my desk at home where I put it through an X through any day where I have an obligation, and January is already full of X's. So my wife's desire to get me out of the house and out from underfoot seems to be realized. She's very happy about that. So it looks like I'm going to be very busy. There's some other things I'm doing. We were blessed this year because both of my sons were home for Christmas with their families, and my sons and I are going to Italy in March, so I'm very excited about that.
Okay, well, that's great. Well, I'm sure you'll keep busy.
Oh, I plan to.
It's hard to imagine not keeping busy. I think to some extent we're wired similarly. Every day is a day to do something.
It
so,
is.
But I've appreciated having you help us start ESI Bites, and I'm looking forward to a scaled-back, manageable, interesting show that we can do this year. And I want to thank you for joining us here at ESI Bites, Judge Facciola. It's been a pleasure.
It's been my pleasure.
Your knowledge of us. Okay. And I'd like to thank Jurinov for their continued support. And if you've enjoyed the podcast, go to esibites.com for a complete list of our show. So come to ESI Bites, learn more about e-discovery before ESI Bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, wishing you a nice day.